Several months ago, I gave a sermon entitled The Vanity Experiments, and I had promised a part two to that message, and I, for a short while, was thinking I'd give something else, but then I started feeling guilty. So I'm going to give today part two of The Vanity Experiments. If you haven't heard part one, it would help certainly set the stage more so than me just giving a quick review, which I will do. In part one, by introduction, I asked, what was the greatest fear that man has? And I answered, it's not death. Many people would say death, but really it's meaninglessness. The idea that you can live, you know, go unnoticed, end your life after many years and having not accomplished or having no meaning, lasting meaning. Of course, Ecclesiastes, the book of Ecclesiastes, is the question to which the rest of the Bible is the answer. And I defined what I call the vanity experiment, of course, conducted by Solomon, the wisest, smartest man, of course, apart from Christ, who ever lived. 1 Kings 4:29, just to read one verse, you don't need to turn there, about Solomon, says, "And God gave Solomon wisdom and exceedingly great understanding and largeness of heart," or mind or intellect, "like the sand on the seashore." He's a good person for us to understand his life, what he learned. Of course, God records that for us and for all mankind, that we can learn the lessons that Solomon learned without having to do and live the way that Solomon did. Of course, Solomon had the resources, unlike any other person who's ever lived, to conduct this experiment without limitations. And he did. He had a goal like mankind does. You know, mankind searches for happiness, and then lasting happiness and meaning and permanence. If you think about that, we all do that. We want happiness, but we want lasting happiness. Beyond that, we want meaning and permanence. Solomon asks the question, what profit or advantage or remainder, what lasting effect has a man from all his labor in which he toils or labors for under the sun? That's the big question asked by the book of Ecclesiastes 1 verse 3. And of course, the book in Solomon's life goes to demonstrate his experimentations, his experiments that he conducted in trying to find the answer. Of course, the problem is where he was looking, under the sun. He was looking to everything and anything that he can find on earth, that he could try, that he could experience. That was his primary focus, with the result or conclusion that all is vanity, which is really not true. All is vanity apart from God, is really what the lesson is. And he discovered the sources of vanity. This is all a review of what I covered in part one, is the sameness and indifference of evil and good. He had seen these things as reasons why, or sources of that vanity. Time as an endless cycle, death as a certain and final end of life. Again, he missed the big picture. He didn't have the understanding, at least in some respects, the depth and breadth and width of understanding that we have. And, of course, the view of God as an unknowable mystery. And I read the verses that covered that. But today, in part two, I want to cover what were those experiments? What were the vanity experiments that he conducted? And there were many, you know, in one sense, an endless number of experiments that Solomon conducted. Why? Because he had the resources. And we can list them and we can go through them. And that's initially what I was going to do. The obvious, you know, marriages, pleasure, wisdom, power, politics, control, money, sex, whatever you want to think of. Solomon had access to all of that in the means to engage in anything he could in search for that meaning, happiness, and permanence. My method today will be, of course, learning about Solomon's experiments by using King David as a benchmark or a metric. Sometimes it's easier, just as we look to Christ as an example that we can learn from and try to explain how and why we should do the things that we should do. I want to use David as a contrast, of course, Solomon's father. In doing so, you can see the difference in the type of experiments, so to speak, that they lived. David on the one end of the spectrum and Solomon on the other. And it really helps paint a picture. Because in Solomon's mind, as we can be guilty of as well, he was on point. He was on target with his Christianity, so to speak. But his experiment felt like he could gain more happiness, more permanence than what God offered. Because God offered it to him specifically and directly. So he thought he could, in essence, remain on this path and vary to the left through experimentation of whatever you want to fill in the blanks with. He could vary to the right and learn something, gain some greater depth of understanding or human experience. So again, he felt like he was on track, and we'll see that. But of course, he wasn't. And I want to start with King David in the contrast with Solomon that we can see in scriptures. And I have three main points today we'll cover. That's the first one is a summary, in essence, starting with the big picture and working a little smaller. Ultimately, Solomon's success, if I can use that word, I've got it in parentheses in my notes, came from or was a result of God's blessing to David. Again, it wasn't all those things that we might attribute it to. When I say success, again, the money, the power, the prestige, the popularity, the wisdom, the understanding, the depth, all those things, the architecture, the technology that Solomon implemented with that mind of unlimited capacity, like any other human, the Bible tells us. That really wasn't what led to, quote unquote, his success. It was really a blessing from and through God to David. Again, those things contributed to Solomon's success, so to speak, in his experimentation. If you're the smartest person on earth, you're going to come up with some pretty ingenious things. You're going to be able to negotiate treaties with countries that other people couldn't. But again, his true and lasting success, if there is much, which we'll see, came from David, from David's obedience to God. If you would, turn to 2 Samuel 7. 2 Samuel 7, we'll begin in verse 1. 2 Samuel 7, verse 1. And again, this is God's promise to David. After the king was settled in his palace, and the Lord had given him rest from all his enemies around him. It's important. God had given David rest. Verse 2, he said to Nathan the prophet, "Here I am living in a house of cedar, while the ark of God remains in a tent." You can see David's heart, his motivation. You might say, well, he should have thought of that before he built his palace. Arguably, maybe. But again, he's thinking about God. He's thinking about the Ark of the Covenant. He's thinking about a place for God, a dwelling place, rather than a tent. What's interesting, verse 3, Nathan replied to the king, "Whatever you have in mind, go ahead and do it, for the Lord is with you." But that night, the word of the Lord came to Nathan, saying, verse 5, "Go and tell my servant David." My servant David. We'll spend some time on that later. This is what the Lord says. "Are you the one to build me a house to dwell in? I have not dwelt in a house from the day I brought the Israelites up out of Egypt to this day." God says, I haven't had a house, a permanent residence, for plus or minus 300 years. I've lived in a tent, God tells David. In verse 6. Continuing, "I have been moving from place to place with a tent as my dwelling." Verse 7, "Wherever I have moved with all the Israelites, did I ever say to any of their rulers whom I commanded to shepherd my people, Israel, why have you not me built a house of cedar?" God says, "David, I appreciate the thought. I appreciate the concern. I've been living in a tent, a temporary tabernacle, for 300 plus years. I've never asked any leader to build me anything." You can see it wasn't God's motivation to have some tabernacle or a temple built to his honor. It was David's motivation. It's interesting. David initiates the idea. Continuing in verse 12. Verse 12 of 2 Samuel 7. God, again, makes a promise here of David's heritage, which Solomon benefits from. Verse 12, "When your days are over and you rest with your ancestors, I will raise up your offspring to succeed you, your own flesh and blood, and I will establish his kingdom. He is the one who will build a house for my name, and I, God, will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. Verse 15, skipping to verse 15, but my love will never be taken away from him, Solomon, as I took it away from Saul, whom I removed from before you. Your house and your kingdom will endure forever before me. Your throne will be established forever. So again, we could be under the false assumption, if you do a historical review of Solomon, thinking that his mind, his intellect, even his request for wisdom, which God says, because you've asked for this, I will, in essence, bless you. But he'd already promised a blessing to Solomon. If Solomon hadn't asked for wisdom, he'd still be blessed. He'd still have God on his side. Again, so Solomon contributed and certainly asked for a good thing. But when you look at Solomon and his life of experimenting with everything under the sun, he had, as a promise, through David, success. And success beyond measure. But you contrast that with Solomon's vanity experiment. So again, on one end of the scale, you see David being blessed, not just as in David's life, but his offspring, his heritage, his son. Well, the kingdom will never depart from David's name. 1 Kings 11, verse 11, we see the contrast with Solomon and his experiment. What did that bring Solomon? What did Solomon actually deserve based on his experiments, on his lifestyle, on his decisions, on his religion or lack thereof? 1 Kings 11, verse 11. 1 Kings 11, verse 11. Therefore, the Lord said to Solomon, because you have done this and have not kept my covenant and my statutes, which I have commanded you, I will surely tear the kingdom away from you and give it to your servant. Verse 12. Nevertheless, I will not do it in your days for the sake of your father David. See, Solomon, you don't deserve any of this. You don't deserve what I've given you, but I've made a promise to your father, David, and I'm going to uphold that promise, regardless of what you've done, which he did many, many errors, we'll see. I will tear it out of the hand of your son, verse 13. However, I will not tear away the whole kingdom. I will give one tribe to your son for the sake of my servant, David, and for the sake of Jerusalem, which I have chosen. That hurts. You know, it hurts to say, you know, I want to punish you, Solomon, like you've never seen. But I made a promise to your dad that I'm not going to do that. On behalf of David and my people, you're going to go effectively unpunished. He didn't deserve that. But again, God keeps his word, and he made that promise to David. So again, Solomon, when we look at his literature, look at what he taught, again, he had wisdom. And we can learn from that wisdom. But again, his life of experimenting with everything under the sun, which appears, I believe, 29 times in the book of Ecclesiastes, he just tried everything. And it got him into trouble, of course. So again, the first point I wanted to make is that summary, the contrast of Solomon to his father David. David on one end of the spectrum, Solomon on the other. It's important to set that stage, because without it, we'd miss the storyline. The second point I want to make is the work. In the book of Ecclesiastes, Solomon asks over and over about the work. You know, the word toil and work and labor appears over and over and over and over, because he's trying to answer the question of, with our lives, the things that we put time into, what lasting profit is there from that work? From the things that we find ourselves entangled in or contributing our time and effort and resources to, what's the result of that work? I want to focus on one important aspect is, you know, David prepared to build the temple. David prepared to build the temple. His motivation, again, was for the temple. God didn't ask for it. So again, really, David initiates the whole temple, a throne room, the Holy of Holies. He initiates the desire for that. And God, of course, gives instructions and the blueprint, so to speak. And David wants to build that. That's in his heart. If you would, turn to 1 Chronicles 22. 1 Chronicles 22, verse 1. First Chronicles 22, verse 1. Then David said, "This is the house of the Lord God, and this is the altar of burnt offering for Israel." Verse 2. So David commanded to gather the aliens who were in the land of Israel, and he appointed masons to cut hewn stones to build the house of God. Verse 3. And David prepared iron in abundance for the nails of the doors of the gates and for the joints, and bronze in abundance beyond measure. Verse 4, and cedar trees in abundance. For the Sidonians and those from Tyre brought much cedar wood to David. Verse 5, now David said, "Solomon, my son, is young and inexperienced, and the house to be built for the Lord must be exceedingly magnificent, famous and glorious throughout all countries. I will now make preparation for it." So David made abundant preparations before his death. Verse 14, continuing in verse 14. "Indeed, I, David, having taken much trouble to prepare for the house of the Lord 100,000 talents of gold and 1,000,000 talents of silver and bronze and iron beyond measure, for it is so abundant, I have prepared timber and stone also, and you may add to them." That's what he tells Solomon. "Yeah, you can add to it if you want. But it's not going to be critically important because I put my heart into this, Solomon. I put everything into it. His own personal wealth he put into it." But again, he doesn't tell Solomon not to, but he also doesn't command Solomon to add to it. Again, it may have been by need. It's not recorded specifically. But again, you may add to them. Verse 15, "Moreover, there are workmen with you in abundance, woodsmen and stonecutters and all types of skillful men for every kind of work. Of gold and silver and bronze and iron, there is no limit. Arise and begin working, and the Lord will be with you." Of course, 4 years later, Solomon began that temple. But it's interesting. 100,000 talents of gold. We read in part one of this that Solomon's annual income in gold alone, Solomon's annual income that came into the kingdom was 666 talents of gold. Again, an interesting number, as I alluded to before. But still, 100,000 talents of gold David accumulated, that's the equivalent of 150 years of Solomon's annual gold income that David prepared in advance. Where was his heart? Well, you put your money where your mouth is. David did. That's a lot of dough. 100,000 talents of gold in today's numbers is $73.2 billion. That's on the lower end of the units, but $73.2 billion. And 1,000,000 talents of silver equals $15.1 billion for a total of $88 billion. That's not counting all the timbers, the stones, all those other materials. That's just, in essence, precious metals. So David, where was his heart? He puts it all into preparing for the temple. He wants to build it. Does Solomon actually care to build that temple? Again, it's not recorded that he had a bad attitude about it or anything like that. But still, David prepares to build the temple. And we'll see what Solomon does. This is an interesting little thing I got to thinking, by today's standards, what's the most expensive building on earth? Anybody know what it is? Anybody want to guess? It's in America. New York City. That's right. One World Trade Center is the most expensive building built on earth. Anybody know what it's cost to build that building? $4 billion. So Solomon, in today's standards, amassed on behalf of God for his home the equivalent of 22 of those buildings. So again, Solomon accumulates $88 billion. World Trade Center costs $4 billion. That's amazing. Where was David's heart? Man, he put everything into the preparing for that temple that God said you can't build. That'd be hard to do. I don't know about you, but if somebody told me, I want to build this, you know, you can accumulate all the stuff for it, Horvath, but you can't build it. I'd be like, never mind. Here's a check, you know. I mean, you would lose, wouldn't you? I would. Not David. He prepared with it vigorously. He was happy to do what he did. Let's look at Solomon in contrast. Solomon in contrast. 1 Kings 9, verse 15. 1 Kings 9, verse 15. The problem with Solomon, as I see it, is that Solomon never stopped building for himself. Solomon never stops building in his 40-year reign. We'll see that. I'm not saying that, you know, he built a temple and I'm sure did a great job with it and got it done, I assume, quickly. It took 7 years. He began it in the fourth year of his reign. I don't know if that means anything. I don't want to read into anything. That's not there. But I can turn to 1 Kings 9, verse 15. And this is the reason for the labor force which King Solomon raised. Again, he raised one of the largest workforces ever amassed at that time from his own people, from aliens, you know, foreigners. But it got to a point where people, there's a passage that says he did not force labor on Israelites. But effectively, he did. If you're in the military, you're required to work, not just be in the military. We'll see that. And this is the reason for the labor force which King Solomon raised to build the house of the Lord. That's a good thing, Solomon. His own house, the Milo, the wall of Jerusalem, Hazor, Megiddo, and Gezer, verse 17. And Solomon built Gezer, lower Beth Horon, verse 18, Baalath, and Tadmor in the wilderness, in the land of Judah, all of the storage cities that Solomon had. Why? Because I got so much stuff. I got to keep renting storage units. I got to keep building. And that's the reason he had this massive workforce. It didn't stop with the temple. And then everybody gets a break. Solomon just kept them cruising for 40 years. All the storage cities that Solomon had, cities for his chariots and cities for his cavalry. And whatever Solomon desired to build in Jerusalem, in Lebanon, and in all the land of his dominion. That's the reason he had this massive workforce. And he kept them going nonstop. The Bible actually describes, you know, 10,000 men per shift. I mean, they just run shifts 24 hours a day. He never stopped building. Again, David's heart was, I want to build this temple. You don't read anything. There's no verse I could find where David says, I want to build this and that, and then I'll build this. He built a palace for himself, sure. But King Solomon just never quit. And, quite frankly, if I'm the wealthiest man on earth and the smartest, I'd do the same. That would be one of my experiments. I'd just keep on building. Solomon did. But what did he get for that? Obviously, it didn't help. It didn't help. Ecclesiastes 2, verse 4. Ecclesiastes 2, verse 4. Again, so Solomon built anything and everything he desired. There's no end to that. And it took a toll on Israel nationally to the point where, of course, they later split at his death. Ecclesiastes 2, verse 4. I made my works great. I built myself houses and planted myself vineyards. Verse 5, I made myself gardens and orchards, and I planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made myself water pools from which to water the growing trees of the grove. Again, Solomon, I made myself this, I made myself this. And why not? If you got, you know, if you're the wealthiest man on earth, smart, he could design stuff, I'm sure, like nobody's business. You know, you would do that. It'd be hard not to. But again, it's different than David. It's by far different than David. So again, the works that Solomon sought, again, there were many. You know, look at marriages of 700 women and 300 concubines. That's a lot of work, you know. But I don't want to focus on all of those, because a lot of those are more obvious to me. But Solomon had his hand. What he set his hand to was different. What motivated him was different in contrast to David. My third point, which will be where we spend most of the time, because this is by far the most important lesson I found in studying Solomon, is that basically the idea of his servant relationship with the sovereign God and God's people, it lacked. So again, my third point is we must look at the servant relationship with the sovereign God and God's people. As a leader, David or Solomon, they were to be servant leaders for the sovereign God and God's people. Well, with that in mind, let's see the contrast. And this is where we'll spend the bulk of the time. The word sovereign, which appears often in relation to King David, means Lord, of course. You know, king, master, supreme being or supreme and permanent authority. And David understood that. This is one of those little interesting things that sometimes I trip on. Is I just did a word search. In regards to David, King David, your servant, again, where David says, you know, your servant David, or somebody else might be referring to that. But those words, in reference to David, your servant, appear 16 times in the Bible. His, or the servant of the Lord, in reference to David, where somebody saying, you know, David, the servant of the Lord, or he could even be saying his servant, referred to God's servant, appears 8 times. My servant, where God is speaking about David, appears 23 times, for a total, my servant, so to speak, references of 47 times. That's pretty good. No wonder he was a man after God's own heart. If God can call you my servant, that's a good thing. If you can say of yourself, I am God's servant, that's a good thing. How often do we hear those words in reference to Solomon? Anybody want to guess? How many times my servant in some form or fashion is it used in connection with Solomon? Anybody want to guess? Once. One time. That's a quick way to see something, to paint a picture. And curiously enough, who says that? Solomon says that. Solomon says it. God never says it. Nobody else ever says it about Solomon. That's interesting. That tells us something. Certainly does. However, in contrast, again, not that we can draw too many conclusions from these things, but in the book of Ecclesiastes, I, my, or myself appears, again, this is Solomon, of course, referring to himself, 126 times. Because if you're the richest man, probably good looking, you have the fastest cars, the fastest chariots, all the hot women, all the money coming in, popularity, notoriety, people coming to see you, you're going to say I, my, and myself quite a bit. But you're not going to hear my servant very often. In fact, he never heard it. He says it one time. That tells a story. That tells a story. So in my point three here about servant relationship with the sovereign God and God's people, I've got some sub-points. I'm just going to break them down because it's easier for me to do so. The first idea is that true wisdom and understanding or largeness of heart. Let's compare that between David and Solomon. It says that Solomon had not just wisdom, not just understanding, but he had largeness of heart. He had a capacity, like the sand on the seashores, it says, to be smart, to retain, to learn, to grow information. That's pretty impressive. But let's see true wisdom. What does that equate to in true wisdom? Of course, we can look at the book of Psalms and learn a lot, which we're not going to. But let's take a look at David in 2 Samuel 7, verse 18. Okay, let's look at David's true wisdom. 2 Samuel 7, verse 18. We were there earlier when God made his promise, his heritage promises to David. 2 Samuel 7, verse 18. This is David's response. And you'll see true wisdom, true understanding, and true largeness of heart in a good and more meaningful way than Solomon's largeness of heart. You'll see that the word heart, as I go through the rest of this message, is used over and over and over and over. Again, 2 Samuel 7, verse 18. Then King David went in and sat before the Lord, and he said, "Who am I, sovereign Lord? And what is my family that you have brought me this far?" Verse 19. And as if it were not enough in your sight, sovereign Lord, you have also spoken about the future of the house of your servant. And this decree, sovereign Lord, is for a mere human. There's wisdom for you. There's wisdom. Verse 20. What more can David say to you? For you know your servant, sovereign Lord. For the sake of your word and according to your will, you have done this great thing and made it known to your servant. Verse 22. How great you are, sovereign Lord. There's no one like you, and there is no God but you, as we have heard with our own ears. And who is like your people Israel, the one nation on earth that God went out to redeem as a people for himself, and to make a name for himself, and to perform great and awesome wonders. And he gives an important key that Solomon misses later, by driving out nations and their gods from before your people, whom you redeemed from Egypt. Verse 24, you have established your people Israel as your very own forever, and you, Lord, have become their God. Now, there's an attitude and approach of wisdom, understanding, and largeness of heart, but not the same type of largeness of heart that Solomon had, which we'll see in contrast. Turn to Ecclesiastes 1, verse 12. Again, we'll see Solomon's approach, or at least part of it. Solomon, in Ecclesiastes 1, verse 12, writes, and of course, he gets off track early in his rule. Ecclesiastes 1, verse 12, I, the preacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem, and I set my heart to seek and search out wisdom concerning all that is done under heaven. And we've talked about that certainly in part one. This burdensome task which God has given to the sons of man, by which they may be exercised. Verse 14, I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and indeed all is vanity and grasping for the wind. Verse 16, I communed with my heart, saying, look, I have attained greatness and have gained more wisdom than all who were before me in Jerusalem. My heart has understood great wisdom and knowledge. Well, sure he did. He knew. You had a math problem, he could solve it. You want to write an essay, get him on your homework team, because he's smart. He's bright. He can negotiate anything. He's the smartest person who has ever lived till now. That's impressive. But that's what he learned. I've gained all this wisdom, but it does not sound, of course, like David, his father. Read the Psalms. All that love literature, that expression, I could not write the book of Psalms. I don't have my personality to do that. David did. His largeness of heart was a love affair with God. Solomon's largeness of heart was a love affair with wisdom, understanding, knowledge gained and learned through any and all experimentations on earth. Totally different. Totally different. 1 Kings 3, verse 1. 1 Kings 3, verse 1 gives us a result. Okay, Solomon, what's the result of your approach towards wisdom, understanding, and largeness of heart? Well, this begins some of the details. We can flesh out why and how we know these things. 1 Kings 3, verse 1. Now Solomon made a treaty with Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and married Pharaoh's daughter. Then he brought her to the city of David until he had finished building his own house in the house of the Lord and the wall around Jerusalem. Now, I read right through that, blitzed right through that a couple of times and didn't pick up on anything. But when you start to see it, it says so much. The first of which is my point B under this point number three, my point A was regarding true wisdom and understanding and largeness of heart. My part B is Solomon made affinity. Solomon made affinity. When it says he made a treaty with Pharaoh, that's problem number one. It literally means a relationship. Make oneself a daughter's husband. That's what the word means. So it's not like, oh, I fell in love with this girl. I can't do without my high school sweetheart. I've got to marry her. No, I need to engage in this treaty. I need to come into a relationship with the king. What do I do to get to that point? I'll marry his daughter. It's a little bit different, isn't it? None of the ladies want to hear that. You know, I didn't really marry you because I loved you. I married because your dad's rich. He's powerful. Nobody wants to hear that. Well, that's just the first problem Solomon makes. Well, not maybe not the first, but one of them. Exodus 34, verse 12, you don't need to turn to all these verses, tells us about that approach. And Solomon, being full of wisdom, knowledge, understanding, and capacity to learn, he had read this. He probably could cite it. Exodus 34, verse 12, told Solomon, "Take heed to yourself, lest you make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land where you are going, lest it be a snare in your midst." Verse 15, skipping to verse 15, "lest you make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land, and they play the harlot with their gods and make sacrifice to their gods, and one of them invites you, and you eat of a sacrifice." Verse 16, again, result, "and you take of his daughters for your sons." That's exactly what Solomon did. He took of their daughter to be his son, in wedding or in marriage. "And his daughters play the harlot with their gods, and you make your sons play the harlot with their gods." Solomon, being as smart as he was, he knew this. He would have understood that. Did David? Who did he marry? We'll see that in a little bit. I won't get ahead of myself. So again, the first issue, just in these first three verses, first verse, actually, of 1 Kings 3, verse 1. The first problem is he made a treaty. Again, he made an alliance. He made an affinity with Egypt, and he should not have done that. Well, you can't trust God to make things work. You can't trust in God's protection, his deliverance, his blessings, the national blessings that he promised to David. It's on your shoulder, Solomon. You're so smart. You can outsmart God. You can achieve these things to a greater extent than if you just want straight and narrow path. Solomon figured, well, hey, I can negotiate this. I'm the smartest man on earth. And he did. Second part of that problem is Solomon married Pharaoh's daughter. Deuteronomy 7, verse 3, Solomon would have known. He would have read. He would have known this. Deuteronomy 7, verse 3 says, "Nor shall you make marriages with them. You shall not give your daughter to their son, nor take their daughter for your son, for they will turn your sons away from following me." That's exactly where Solomon went. God says, "Don't stick your hand in the fire." Solomon walks over and sticks his hand in the fire. Why? Because I'm the smartest man on earth. I'm an experiment. I can stay on this path that God has set me on, and I can deviate to the left, experiment. I can deviate to the right and experiment, but I will keep it on track. Solomon could not keep it on track, and neither can we. How about David? I got to thinking, well, who is the wife of David? Bathsheba. I thought, well, it's Bathsheba. That's his wife. Well, I'd forgotten. David had six more named wives. Of course, they're all Hebrew names, interestingly. You know, David didn't marry outside of Israel. He didn't do what Solomon did. You can find that in 2 Samuel 3. They're named. David also had more wives and concubines that aren't named. That's referenced in 2 Samuel 5, verse 13 reads, "And David took more concubines and wives from Jerusalem after he had come from Hebron. Also more sons and daughters were born to David." But again, key phrase, from Jerusalem. David didn't take wives from all the nations around, all the leading families, to gain power in that experiment, to gain prestige in his experiment, to gain wealth and trade routes. David didn't do that. There's nothing specifically wrong with Solomon's 700 wives and 300 concubines. Now, it seems kind of stupid to me, if you're asking, but there wasn't any command against it. It's who he took for those wives and concubines. David was not guilty of that. Let's look at Solomon, 1 Kings 11, verse 1. 1 Kings 11, verse 1. "But Solomon loved many foreign women as well as the daughter of Pharaoh, women of the Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Sidonians, and Hittites. Verse 2, from the nations, not doesn't say from Jerusalem or of his own people, from the nations of whom the Lord had said to the children of Israel, you shall not intermarry with them, nor they with you. Surely they will turn away your hearts after their gods. Solomon clung to these in love. Verse 3, and he had 700 wives, princesses, and 300 concubines, and his wives turned away his heart. Again, specifically commanded, do not make covenants, treaties, alliances, affinities with foreign nations. And two, do not marry them. He does them both, basically immediately. Not the same heart as David. Not the same heart. Nehemiah 13, verse 25. Don't need to turn there. I'll just read this. Nehemiah 13, verse 25. Nehemiah writes, so I contended with them and cursed them, struck some of them and pulled out their hair. Nehemiah was pretty feisty. And made them swear by God, saying, you shall not give your daughters as wives to their sons, nor take their daughters for your sons or yourselves. Verse 26, did not Solomon, king of Israel, sin by these things? Yet among many nations there was no king like him. Why? Because Solomon was so great. Because God had promised Solomon's greatness. Otherwise, God would have taken it from him. Again, Solomon contributed, of course. Don't get me wrong. But yet among many nations, there was no king like him who was beloved of his God. Yeah, God promised that love to him. And God made him king over all Israel. Nevertheless, pagan women caused even him to sin. Should we then hear of your doing all this great evil, transgressing against our Lord God by marrying pagan women? Solomon knew exactly what he should and shouldn't do. He just felt like he could, experiment and get away with it. Do something else. Learn more. Gain more understanding. Bend the rules. And that's what Solomon did. Josephus writes, interestingly, think of secular historian like Josephus picking up on these things, recording them. But he does in Antiquities of the Jews, Book 8, Chapter 7, Section 5. Solomon was fallen headlong into unreasonable pleasures and regarded not those admonitions for when he had married 700 wives, the daughters of princes and of eminent persons. And 300 concubines, and those besides the king of Egypt's daughter, he soon was governed by them until he came to imitate their practices. He was forced to give them this demonstration of his kindness and affection to them, to live according to the laws of their countries. And as he grew into years and his reason became weaker by length of time, it was not sufficient to recall to his mind the institutions of his own country, so he still more and more condemned his own God and continued to regard the gods, small g, that his marriages had introduced. God says, don't do it. Don't make alliances and don't marry them because they'll lead your heart away. Your largeness of heart is not going to save you if you do that. Your brilliance, your wisdom, your understanding, power, wealth, money, prestige, whatever it is, it's just too strong a pull. You're not going to be able to fight that. God told him. Solomon didn't listen. My point D under this servant relationship that wasn't really there with Solomon is that Solomon brought his wives to Jerusalem, to the city of David, the house of David. I won't spend much time on this, but it says in 2 Chronicles 8, verse 11, 2 Chronicles 8, verse 11, this is 20 years into his rule, plus or minus. 20 years. Into his rule. Now Solomon brought the daughter of Pharaoh up from the city of David. That's where she was living. In Jerusalem. Up from the city of David to the house he had built for her. Again, he had to build the temple. He had to build his own house. And then he built a house for Pharaoh's daughter. Again, roughly 20 years into his rule. For Solomon says, my wife shall not dwell in the house of David, king of Israel, because the places to which the ark of the Lord has come were holy. That sounds so good. Well, David, She kept her there for 20 years, along with the other foreign wives. What type of example does that set when a leader, a spiritual leader as well, national leader, marries all these foreign wives, specifically commanded against, brings them into the home city, into the capital city, and lives there for 20 years. Then he admits, you know, I'm getting them out of here because that's not right. It's not good to have them here. It seems like a double standard. It sounds like he's bending the rules for about 20 years, doesn't it? It does to me. My point E, if you're taking notes, and probably the most important point I will make, is that Solomon worshipped at high places. Solomon worshipped at high places. Very specific wording, which is an issue of the heart. And Solomon worshipped at high places, which is an issue of the heart. When we look at the kings of Israel and Judah, God normally summarizes his feeling about them in one or two sentences. You know, they live a long time, may rule a long time, but God's pretty to the point. In a sentence or two, and he often refers to high places as a metric, as a way to measure a king's success, if you will, how satisfied he was with that king. Of course, the record for both is not good. Very few exceptions, David, Asa, Hezekiah, and Josiah. You know, there aren't very many good kings of either Judah or Israel, northern tribes. But the critical point of the high places, as we'll see, is they facilitated idolatry, which, of course, leads away from God. 1 Kings 3, verse 3. 1 Kings 3, verse 3. We read of Solomon, and we don't read this, of course, of David. 1 Kings 3, verse 3. And Solomon loved the Lord. Well, that's good, Solomon. That is good. Walking in the statutes of his father David, again, for a while. It doesn't say that he did that forever. Of course, committing idolatry and worshiping other gods and building idols and high places to other gods is not following in the footsteps of God's law or King David. But again, 1 Kings 3, verse 3, and Solomon loved the Lord, walking in the statutes of his father David, except that he sacrificed and burned incense at the high places. Well, what does that mean? Deuteronomy 12, verse 1 gives the prescribed place of worship. Where should Solomon have worshipped the Lord? Prior to the building of the temple, and even after. It's not real clear, but Solomon may have continued to worship at multiple places. I don't know if that's true or not, but it doesn't. Deuteronomy 12, verse 1 gives the prescribed place of worship. Again, Solomon, being the wisest, smartest man, with capacity, mind capacity, but beyond measure, like the sand of the seashore. He would have known this. Deuteronomy 12, verse 1. These are the statutes and judgments, of course, given to Israel as they come out of the land of Egypt. These are the statutes and judgments which you shall be careful to observe in the land which the Lord God of your fathers is giving you to possess all the days that you live on earth, including you, Solomon. Verse 2, you shall utterly destroy all the places where the nations which you shall dispossess serve their gods, on the high mountains and on the hills, and under every green tree. Verse 3, and you shall destroy their altars, break their sacred pillars, and burn their wooden images with fire. You shall cut down the carved images of their gods and destroy their names from that place. Verse 4, you shall not worship the Lord your God with such things. That's pretty straightforward. Pretty straightforward, Solomon. Any part of that you didn't understand? Yeah, everything. Verse 8, skipping to verse 8. You shall not at all do as we are doing here today, every man doing what is right in his own eyes. Again, that's exactly what Solomon did. Don't enter into alliances. I'm going to do that. Don't marry foreign wives. I'm going to do that. Don't worship at high places. I'm going to do that. Destroy them. No, I'm not going to destroy them. I'm going to build more. All those things Solomon did. He would have known these verses as the smartest man on earth. His key summary found in 2 Kings 17, verse 7. 2 Kings 17, verse 7 tells us something about these high places, the result of high places. And this is specifically for Solomon. the northern 10 tribes after the national split, you know, why Israel, the northern 10 tribes, why they were carried away to Assyria. Why national captivity for this group of God's people? 2 Kings 17, verse 7. For so it was that the children of Israel had sinned against the Lord their God, who had brought them up out of the land of Egypt from under the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And they had feared other gods, verse 8, and had walked in the statutes of the nations whom the Lord had cast out from before the children of Israel and of the kings of Israel, which they had made. Verse 9, and the children of Israel secretly did against the Lord their God things that were not right. And they built for themselves high places in all their cities, from watchtower to fortified city. They set up for themselves sacred pillars and wooden images on every high hill and under every green tree. There they burned incense on all the high places, like the nations whom the Lord had carried away before them. And they did wicked things to provoke the Lord to anger. Verse 12, for they served idols, of which the Lord had said to them, you shall not do this thing. Again, the scriptures, of course, after Solomon here in this case. But again, an example of high places is very clear from the get-go in God's command, in God's law, to God's nation. Don't do that. Destroy it. Rid it like a plague. Burn idols. Destroy altars. And surely don't build them. Solomon did not do that. For southern Israel, or Judah, well, I'll just read a couple quick verses about four successive kings to Judah. I think Judah was guilty of the same thing. You don't need to turn to these. But again, to make the point regarding high places. Jehoash, 2 Kings 12, verse 2, God records, Jehoash did what was right in the sight of the Lord all the days in which Jehoiada, the priest, instructed him. But the high places were not taken away. The people still sacrificed and burned incense on high places. Amaziah, Joash's son, in 2 Kings 14, verse 3, and he did what was right in the sight of the Lord, yet not like his father David. He did everything as his father Joash had done. However, the high places were not taken away, and the people still sacrificed and burned incense on the high places. 2 Chronicles 25, verse 2, don't need to turn here, but it gives us an important point about what does that mean. Okay, so these kings, these rulers, these leaders continue to either do it themselves or allow it within the nation. But what does that mean? What reflection is that other than they're breaking the command of God, the law of God? What else does it tell us about them? 2 Chronicles 25, verse 2, because it also goes on to say Uzziah and Jotham, the next two kings, did the same thing. High places, we're cool with it. You guys want to have high places? Great. I'll contribute. I'll help. I'll turn my head the other way. But what does that say about the leader? 2 Chronicles 25, verse 2, and he, Amaziah in this case, did what was right in the sight of the Lord, but not with a loyal heart. As you notice, even with Solomon and these kings that I've read, it's often the problem is it's the most difficult thing to detect. Solomon thinks he's doing the right thing. And in fact, maybe doing a lot of the right things. I'm building the temple. That's a good thing. But again, not with a loyal heart. What does that mean? The word loyal here means whole or complete, perfect or friendly. I'm not doing it wholeheartedly. Think back to David when he's amassing $88 billion for the temple, plus all the building materials. He's doing it wholeheartedly when he can't even build it. Solomon, in this case, does what he does, but again, clearly not with a loyal heart. General compliance, of course, but not wholly committed to God, is the most dangerous vanity experiment. To think you're doing well and generally attempting and trying, that is the most dangerous vanity experiment. To sit in church for 50 years thinking you're doing well. I do a little experimentation with, you know, work hours, with tithes, with prayer, with entertainment, whatever that is. But generally speaking, I'm on track. That is the most dangerous thing. We'll see that clearly. And it's the most important point I can make today. Is that, of course, a high place can represent anything that leads to unloyalty, non-commitment to the Lord. High places, again, even though specifically commanded against, can represent anything. Anything that helps create, foster an attitude of, I'm not loyal. I'm not really committed. I'm on the boat, but I'm not rowing. 1 Kings 8, verse 22. 1 Kings 8, verse 22. Solomon, again, in wisdom, in understanding, in largeness of heart, knew this. He knew that having a loyal heart was expected. Again, that's why I say it's the most dangerous thing. To know what you should do and don't do it, that's the most dangerous experiment we can conduct. It's obvious to say, oh, you shouldn't go to, you shouldn't have adultery. Oh, no, I know that. I shouldn't watch these movies. Oh, I know that. I shouldn't drink till I'm drunk. Oh, I know that. Those are obvious things. But the most dangerous experiment that Solomon conducted is this. He knew better, which we've already seen. All those laws that preceded him, he knew those. But he also admits that he knows it. We'll see that. 1 Kings 8, verse 22. 1 Kings 8, verse 22. This is roughly the 12th year of his reign. After 7 years of building the temple. Then Solomon stood before the altar of the Lord in the presence of all the assembly of Israel. Again, the temple's done. He's addressing the people. It's an exciting moment, exciting time. And spread out his hands toward heaven, verse 23. And he said, Lord God, sovereign God of Israel, there is no God in heaven above or on earth below like you, who keep your covenant and mercy with your servants who walk before you with all their hearts. He addresses it right there before the nation. It's not just obeying, it's doing it with your heart. Skipping to verse 57. Verse 57 of 1 Kings 8. Again, this is Solomon dedicating the temple. He's actually praying to God, dedicating the temple. He's done addressing the people at this point. So he dedicates the temple. Verse 57. May the Lord our God be with us, as he was with our fathers. May he not leave us nor forsake us. He spent a lot of time on what God should do for them. Verse 58. That he may incline our hearts to himself, to walk in all his ways and to keep his commandments and his statutes and his judgments, which he commanded our fathers. All those things we've already read, he knew. He's asking God, we know these things. Help us to remember and obey them with our hearts. Verse 59, and may these words of mine, with which I have made supplication before the Lord, be near the Lord our God day and night, that he may maintain the cause of his servant. Again, there's the time he references himself as a servant. And the cause of his people Israel, as each day may require. It's a beautiful prayer. Verse 60, that all the peoples of the earth may know that the Lord is God. There is no other. Until later. Verse 61, let your heart therefore be loyal to the Lord our God, to walk in his statutes and keep his commandments as at this day. Yeah, as at this day, but unfortunately later, it's all down the drain for Solomon. Everything he's praying there as he dedicates this temple, arguably the most important structure ever built. I mean, what more important structure? Building the temple for God, the first temple. That's a pretty important building project. Like to have that contract. Solomon did a good thing. And he acknowledges, let your heart therefore be loyal. He knows. He even asks for it. 1 Kings 9, verse 4. Here's God's response to Solomon's prayer. 1 Kings 9, verse 4. Again, this is God's second appearance to Solomon. Now, if you walk before me, as your father David walked, in integrity of heart and in uprightness, to do according to all that I have commanded you, and if you keep my statutes and my judgments, then I will establish the throne of your kingdom over Israel forever, as I promised David your father, saying, you shall not fail to have a man on the throne of Israel. But if you or your sons at all turn from following me and do not keep my commandments and my statutes which I have set before you, but go and serve other gods and worship them, then I will cut off Israel from the land which I have given them, and this house which I have consecrated for my name I will cast out of my sight. God never asked for the temple. And he says, you know what? What's important to me, God, is your heart. Is that loyal heart, God, says Solomon, that you just prayed for. This temple is nice, and I appreciate it. But he's saying, as soon as you don't obey, as soon as you don't follow, as soon as you don't have that loyal heart, this temple could come tumbling down, because God did not care about the temple. He didn't need it. So I lived in a tent for 300 years. It's your father David's motivation that wanted this temple. So he says, I have consecrated for my name. I will cast out of my sight. Israel will be a proverb and a byword among all peoples. As for this house, which is exalted, everyone who passes by it will be astonished and will hiss and say, why has the Lord done thus to this land and to this house? Then they will answer, because they forsook the Lord their God who brought their fathers out of the land of Egypt and have embraced other gods and worshiped them and served them. Therefore, the Lord has brought all this calamity on them. 1 Kings 11, verse 4. You don't need to turn to all of these. For it was so when Solomon was old that his wives, sure enough, as the law said would happen, turned his heart after other gods, and his heart was not loyal. Solomon prayed the prayer, let us as a nation have an obedient, a heart that's loyal. And here it says, Solomon did not have a loyal heart. Talk about foreshadowing. Watch what you pray for. Solomon never asked for humility, for guidance. You know, I don't know, all those experiments took its toll. You marry 700 wives, most of which from other nations, in political alliances to gain power, to gain prestige, to gain trade routes, to gain all these things. It's not going to be without effect. And we see the effect here, that his heart was not loyal to the Lord his God, as was the heart of his father David. It's a huge difference. For Solomon went after Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and after Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites. Solomon did evil in the sight of the Lord and did not fully follow the Lord, as did his father David. Then Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the abomination of the Moab, on the hill that is east of Jerusalem, and for the Molech, the abomination of the people of Ammon. And he did likewise for all his foreign wives. Don't enter into treaties. Burn their altars, their high places. Solomon effectively builds hundreds of high places. Did he not get that? Of course he got it. He understood that. I mean, I believe he did. How could he not? How could he not have read the law? My final point, sub-point to my point three, this is a quick one, is Solomon made the yoke heavy for his people. Again, he was a leader. It's part of what we've been focusing on. As a leader of the nation, you know, you can't bring all your foreign wives into the capital. You shouldn't have married in the first place. There are lots of things we can look to, but maybe one more damaging, because remember, God said, this is my people, Israel. For the sake of my people, Solomon, I haven't destroyed you. Solomon made the yoke heavy for God's people. And we mentioned all his building projects. Of course, they never stopped on the back of his people. Ecclesiastes 2, verse 7, you don't need to turn there. I acquired male and female servants. Let me back up, actually. Regarding David, because this is a neat little point, regarding making the yoke heavy. David, in 1 Chronicles 29, verse 6, again, when he's planning and preparing for the temple, how does he go about that? 1 Chronicles 29, verse 6, then the leaders of the fathers' houses, leaders of the tribes of Israel, the captains of thousands and of hundreds, with the officers over the king's work, offered willingly. Verse 9, then the people rejoiced, for they had offered willingly, because with a loyal heart. How about that? The nation had a loyal heart because with a loyal heart they had offered willingly to the Lord. And King David also rejoiced greatly. That sounds so much better. That's the nation I'd rather be a part of. Let's take a look at Solomon, Ecclesiastes 2, verse 7. I acquired male and female servants and had servants born in my house. Yes, I had greater possessions of herds and flocks than all who were in Jerusalem before me. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the special treasures of kings and of the provinces. I acquired male and female singers, the delights of the sons of men, and musical instruments of all kind. Verse 9, so I became great and excelled more than all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also, my wisdom remained with me. Sounds a little bit different. I know it's different because 1 Kings 12, verse 3, my last verse, 1 Kings 12, verse 3 says, don't need to turn here, then Jeroboam and the whole assembly of Israel came and spoke to Rehoboam, of course, Solomon's son, saying, your father, Solomon, made our yoke heavy. Now, therefore, lighten the burdensome service of your father, Solomon, and his heavy yoke, which he put on us, and we will serve you. Solomon built for Solomon. Solomon lived for Solomon. Again, I'm not saying that he didn't accomplish incredible things. I'm sure he did. But at the expense of his people. Of course, Christ came, of course, as a servant, and he says his yoke is not heavy. You want to judge a leader. How does that yoke feel? That's a good way to look at it. And we can study the many experiments of Solomon. Wisdom, knowledge, power, wealth, pleasure, politics, building, popularity, marriages, sex, technology. He accomplished many technical feats, food, trade, commerce, you name it. They're all experiments that he conducted in that search for meaning, lasting meaning and permanence. But the most dangerous then the experiment of Solomon, as we have seen by the contrast between King David and Solomon, was a matter of the heart. In your desire, pursuit, and work for happiness, meaning, and permanence, what will you use or allow to be the excuse, the experiment to justify the undermining of God's truth and the path that was set before you, prepared in advance for you? What experiment will you allow in your life? What are your vanity experiments?